Astronomers are building a map of the universe, pinpointing galaxies up to 380 million light years away. We'll talk about why they need one. Then many prominent doctors are also writers. They say their interest in literature makes them even better physicians. What does Chekhov have to do with checkups? We'll talk about medicine and the humanities, including novelist and pediatric oncologist Chris Adrian. He writes fiction set in hospitals from the perspective of the patients.
I certainly worry that it can be a dark, depressing, and somewhat despairing place, especially for somebody who's under care there.
Finding a way out of that darkness through storytelling, all coming up after the break. Stay with us. Our goal is to keep these podcasts free. Here's how you can help.
You can support the show by trying GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Use GoToMeeting to bring people together, colleagues and clients across the country or around the world, to collaborate in real time. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com and use the promo code SCIENCE. Here's another free offer, Carbonite Online Backup. Carbonite is designed to automatically back up files on PCs and Macs before hard drive crashes, viruses, or other problems occur. To try it free and support the show, visit Carbonite.com and use the offer code Science Friday.
Thank you, Anna. And now, on to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Astronomers are mapping the universe, and they've created what they call the most complete map of the local universe. And while it won't download yet onto your GPS, it does include data on countless galaxies up to 380 million light years away. Now, why is this so important? The map was released this week at the meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Boston, and joining me now to talk about it is Karen Masters, an astronomer at the Institute of Cosmology and Gravitation at the University of Portsmouth in the UK. She joins us by phone from there. Good evening.
Good evening. Good afternoon for you.
Thank you very much. Tell us how much of the universe this is.
Well, to be honest, this is a tiny, tiny fraction of the universe. On astronomical scale, that's why we called it the local universe. Mm-hmm. On astronomical scale, it's relatively nearby, even though on human scales, 380 million light years sounds like a long, long way, and is a long way. Mm-hmm. But if we use redshift, which is sort of the astronomer's way of thinking about distances, this is the speed at which the galaxies appear to be moving away from us because of the expansion of the universe. That's actually how we estimated the distances, or how we measured the distances for this map. And the maximum redshift in this map is much smaller than some other maps that we have of the sky, but they are of much smaller fractions of the sky. Where this map is unique is that it covers 95% of the sky to a uniform depth, unlike other much deeper, further away maps, which just cover smaller areas of the sky.
So you've sort of done a 360 on the sky, but not gone out so far.
That's right. It's always going to be a payoff between how much of the sky you cover and how deep you can go, just because we have only so many telescopes and we have only so much, so many resources available for mapping the universe.
Is it possible to estimate how many galaxies, stars, things like that you have actually mapped?
Well, this map catalogs or lists distances to about 43,000 galaxies.
43,000?
43,000. So it's definitely a countable number. Hmm. That's the number of galaxies we have distances for in this map.
And this project took some 10 years to complete. What was involved in this?
Well, this was a project that was initiated by John Hooker, who was an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And 10 years is probably actually an underestimate of how long this project took. I think John had in mind to do this project as long ago as the late 80s. When proposals were put in to do an all-sky imaging survey in the near-infrared. Now, the reason you would want to go into the near-infrared instead of using sort of optical wavelengths, the kinds of light that we see with our eyes, is that we live in a galaxy, and the galaxy blocks out big chunks of the sky. There's a lot of stuff, stars, dust, and other material in the galaxy. And if we want to see things that are behind that, you know, that are much further away, other galaxies, mm-hmm. we have to be able to see through. through it somehow. In optical light, the galaxy blocks, you know, as much as 20% of the sky. But if you move into the near-infrared, into longer, redder wavelengths, you can see much more of the sky. And something that's called the 2-micron all-sky survey was envisaged by John and by other astronomers in the late 80s and was sort of developed during the 90s and actually was completed in about 2000, I believe.
In fact, Dr. Hooker was on our program several times. And I'm going to play a little bit of a discussion, a clip that he talked about 10 years ago.
I would love to hear that.
One of the key issues, I mean, we think we're getting a better handle. Astronomers overall think we have a better handle on the cosmological model right now. In fact, you probably won't find very many people at all working in the field trying to understand the origin of things and the fate of things who will say that there's anything wrong with the Big Bang model. It works pretty well. A hot Big Bang with a little bit of inflation and a variety of other things does just everything that we need. However, there are still a whole host of really unanswered questions. For example, we know that the universe seems to be made of, in large part, the stuff called dark matter. We don't know what it is. We don't really know where it is. And we think we know how much there is, but we're not even sure about that. I think one of the real key puzzles for the next decade in astronomy is to, and physics for that matter, is to try to understand what the heck dark matter is.
Well, Dr. Masters, here it is 10 years later. Do we know any more what the heck dark matter is?
I would say we're getting closer, actually. I don't think you'd find a single astronomer who would disagree with that most of the matter, most of the gravitating matter in the universe is dark matter. Mm-hmm. And we're getting tantalizingly close in particle accelerators and particle physics experiments to detecting dark matter particles or particles that are sort of predicted that could explain dark matter. So I actually think we're significantly closer to knowing what dark matter is than we were 10 years ago. We're not quite there yet, but I think, you know, it's really teasing now. It really seems to be close on the horizon.
And as you say, this map you're making is just a small part of the universe. What would you learn from it? I mean, I know that when we have maps, we use them to drive distances or fly or take a boat or something. What does an astronomer do with a map once it gets finished?
Well, this is a small part of the universe, but this is our part of the universe. And that's why we want to see everything over the whole sky. Because the things that are near us in the universe have an impact on us, on our galaxy, on the sort of the region of the universe we live in. And we know that the universe has structure on various scales, and these clusters and superclusters of galaxies are extremely massive because of the huge amount of dark matter in them. And they pull, they have gravity, right? So they're pulling on our galaxy and on the galaxies near us. Mm-hmm. We know that our galaxy and the galaxies near us are moving through the universe and are being pulled on by this gravity. And so sort of accounting for where that pull is coming from, just in order to do that, you need a complete all-sky map of the local universe, and that's what we've provided. So hopefully this will help with those kinds of studies. And I know there are actually already some researchers who are using this data to look at that exact question.
I know that we've put a copy on our website at sciencefriday.com of the image from the map, and you can see that the galaxies are not completely evenly distributed. You see sorts of bands of color. Do we know why that is, or is that the dark matter that we don't see in between those bands?
No, the dark matter, so we believe the galaxies, we have evidence that shows the galaxies are tracing where the dark matter is. So you can, if you look at those lines and those structures, those are the superclusters. And actually, I mean, it was John, going back to John, it was him in the 1980s who first showed that galaxies in our universe are not uniformly distributed. If you've ever heard of the famous CFA Stickman, it was the first kind of filamentary structure that was seen in a map, which was just a tiny fraction of what we're seeing here. It looked kind of like a little stick man, so people gave it that name. But those are real structures that we see in the universe, filamentary structures, and the black spaces between them. Not the big black horizontal line across the middle. That's the part of the sky we can't see because of the plane, because of our galaxy. But the black spaces between the coloured dots on the rest of the map are real gaps, real voids and holes where there is no dark matter or little dark matter and few galaxies.
Well, let's get you any closer to understanding what the great majority of the universe is made out of, the dark energy.
I don't believe so, actually. I think what you need to do for dark energy studies are these much deeper, smaller area surveys. And the reason that is that dark energy doesn't have a lot of an impact on the clustering of galaxies. It doesn't, because we think it's smooth, it doesn't have any variation in its gravity. What it does is it affects the overall evolution of the universe. And so in order to look for dark energy and to try to understand about dark energy, you have to see how the universe changes as you look very far back. Because, you know, as we're looking back in at galaxies that are very far away, we're looking back in the history of the universe. So we need very, very deep redshift surveys in order to understand dark energy. So this map is not going to have a lot to say about dark energy.
Mm-hmm. And what would you like to know? What would be the big answer you'd like to, the question you'd like to answer out of this study? What would you like this work to answer for you?
I think if we can truly account for the motion of the Milky Way, the motion of our galaxy in the universe by the structures in this map, I think if we can show without a doubt that that's true, that would be a very powerful statement to make. I think that would be probably the most powerful statement that will come out of this map.
You mean because there's a lot of dark matter in there?
Yeah. So I mean, it has been a little bit of a debate whether or not we're moving too fast for the standard cosmological model. But if we can show that there's enough matter in a single direction or in the direction that it's pulling on us that accounts for that, then that sort of removes that question about the cosmological model. It's just one little niggling kind of, you know, the model works so well, as John explained 10 years ago. The model works so well and it passes so many tests.
Right.
You can always find a few little tests where people are like, well, look, this isn't quite right, and look, this isn't quite right. And one of them has been this motion, our motion in the universe.
You mean the rotary spiral sort of motion of our galaxy?
Yeah. No, actually, the motion of the entire galaxy.
Ah.
So the rotation of our galaxy is one of the big pieces of evidence for dark matter. But our actual motion, and the clearest way you see this actually is in looking at maps of the cosmic microwave background. So this is this is the first light that was emitted in the universe when the universe first became transparent, and we see it everywhere. It's sort of this bath of radiation that we live in, and when you look at that, you see that it's hotter in one direction and colder in the other direction. Mm-hmm. And it has lots of other structures as well, but that's the biggest structure in it. And we explain that by saying we're moving towards in a direction through this path of radiation, and that's what creates this dipole, this structure on the sky. And so that you can measure our motion with respect to this CMB extremely accurately, and some researchers claim that it's too high for the standard cosmological model. But if the two-mass redshift survey, the redshift survey that we've just released, can account for that motion, that kind of removes one of these doubts about the standard model.
Thank you, Dr. Masters. Good luck to you. Thanks for staying up for us. Have a good weekend. Karen Masters, astronomy researcher at the Institute of Cosmology and Gravitation, University of Portsmouth in the UK. When we come back, we're going to talk about telling and reading stories about health. Can it make for better health care? Stay with us. To help keep these podcasts free, we need your support. Here's Anna to tell you how.
Thanks, Ira. This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by GoToMeeting.com, the award-winning web conferencing application for Macs and PCs. One of the ways business gets done these days is by bringing people together, sharing ideas, and collaborating. And more, the people you want to work with are across town, or on the other side of the country, or even around the world. So how can you help them make the best possible contribution to your business or project? It's simple. GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is the web conferencing tool which enables colleagues and clients from remote locations to see your computer desktop on their computer screen, which means you can collaborate from a distance, form closer relationships, and be more effective. Use GoToMeeting for virtual meetings, product demos and reviews, sales presentations, training sessions, and status updates, just about any type of meeting. You can schedule GoToMeetings in advance or hold them on the fly. Try GoToMeeting today and receive a free 30-day trial and help Science Friday, too. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click Try It Free, and enter the promo code SCIENCE. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code SCIENCE. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone. Now, back to the show. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Think about your last trip to the doctor's office. Maybe you had been waiting for what felt like hours. And when the doctor finally rushed in, she spoke quickly about where it hurts, ordered a few tests, typed a few notes on her iPad, and before you knew it, you were out the door with a prescription. But what if it were different? What if instead your doctor spent time with you and listened to you tell her your story, asked about your family and your job? And what if your treatment was based not just on your physical symptoms, but on your whole life story? Can listening to and telling stories help make for better health care? Some med schools think so. Programs in narrative medicine and medical humanities teach doctors lessons from literature in the hopes that they will be better listeners and caregivers. Does your doctor take time to listen to your story? How could a doctor, anyhow, with 10 people in the waiting room, ever have time to listen closely to all of them? What does your doctor do? That's what we'll be talking about. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guests. Nellie Herman is the creative director of the Narrative Medicine Program at Columbia University Medical School. She is also the co-author of The Cure for Grief. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. Dr. Jerome Groopman is a professor at Harvard Med School and the chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He's the author of several books, including How Doctors Think. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Groopman.
Terrific to be with you.
Thank you. Let me ask both of you. Let me ask Dr. Herman first. Do doctors have empathy problems? Do they have problems relating?
I want to say right off the bat, I am not a doctor.
Oh, well.
I am a fiction writer, so that is needs to be clear.
I apologize.
From the get-go. No, that's okay. I just want to make the listeners.
Your mother would have been happy to hear.
I actually love that. I get emails saying Dr. Herman all the time, and it's kind of funny to me. But being not a doctor, I actually hesitate to make sweeping claims about doctors in general. But I have heard from the doctors that I work with that problems of empathy arise more and more as, you know, healthcare becomes more and more compressed and stressful and all that.
Well, tell us then what you do with the doctors that are in your med school.
So what we do in narrative medicine is essentially attempt to bring the skills of narrative, so close reading and reflective writing and sort of attention to story in lots of different ways to doctors in training, also not just doctors, all sorts of healthcare professionals, as a way of teaching them to better attend to their patients as well as to themselves and as well as to each other as teams in the hospital and in other settings.
Mm-hmm. Do doctors have time to spend with their patients listening to stories that their patients may have?
I mean, I think it's less a question of time and more a question of manner. You know, you may only have 15 minutes to listen to a patient, but in those 15 minutes, you can listen very, very differently than, you know, another person may listen. And I think it's, you know, you got to work in the system you're working in. And so, sure, maybe you don't have much time, but there are ways to, you know, listen better, I think. Mm-hmm.
Do you agree, Dr. Groopman?
Well, I do think that there is a problem with empathy. I think most students who enter medical school are very idealistic, deeply humanistic. I think that the system for a while now erodes that. And I agree with Dr. Herman that, or with Ms. Herman.
You could just call me Nellie, that's okay.
that you can listen better, but I do think that the time constraints and also the changes in healthcare are preventing well-intentioned physicians and physicians with the skills to listen from listening. This system is being hijacked by economists because of the crisis in payments. And a typical primary care doctor, and I have one, I have a good internist, but you know, he has to sit and look at his computer screen and check off all of these quality measures and make sure that he fills in a template in an electronic record. And he doesn't have time, and frankly, he doesn't have sort of the cognitive structure to engage me in talking about my story because he has to fill in the blanks. And I think that is a very negative turn in terms of medicine.
Now, Nellie, do you have to teach the doctors how to be good listeners, or do they have to know how to listen to your story that you want to tell them? What kind of training exactly are they lacking that they need to have?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily what they're lacking. I don't want to make any claims as to what they're lacking, but I do think that what we hope that they can get from what we are giving them is a sort of wholer view of the patients that are coming to them and to their work in general. Just sort of, you know, I think what the humanities can teach to everybody is a sort of a way of seeing the world that is a little bit more tolerates ambiguity, tolerates sort of questioning, and I think that is it's very hard, as you can see. I struggle to sort of specifically say what we're teaching.
You want to teach them to look at the patient holistically.
Exactly, and to recognize that the stories that patients tell, even if it's a very simple, you know, symptom story, are sort of multivocal, if that makes sense. You know, it's the patient is coming from a certain place, a certain culture, a certain family, a certain et cetera.
And it's probably meaningful because they volunteered the story to tell you.
Exactly. And they tell it in a very specific way. And, you know, three different people will tell the same stories three different ways. Mm-hmm. So some acknowledgement of that, I think, is useful for someone who works in a profession like that.
Dr. Gruppen, do you expect your internist, when you come for your yearly checkup, let's say, to sit and spend an hour with you to learn everything about you during that checkup?
Well, I think when I first met him several years ago, I wanted him to know about my life, the relationships I had, children, obviously, you know, my occupation, which he was aware of, and things like that, because I think, as Ms. Herman says, you know, when you care for someone as a physician, you don't do it on a strictly biological level. That person exists within the larger context of an environment of relationships, an environment of work, an environment of stresses, all of which are very relevant in terms of how the individual experiences illness, how the individual uses words to communicate symptoms. Because when a patient comes, they're not wearing a sign, you know, with their diagnosis. And even though the knee-jerk response now is, you know, send someone for a CAT scan or a blood test or whatever, you can often get important information, clinical information, from listening to the person's story. Mm-hmm. And also, I think when you recommend a therapy, you want to make sure that that therapy fits within the goals and values and context of the person's life. And it's not generic. You know, as Ms. Herman said, people are different. There's character that comes into it. And I think we fail as physicians if we don't appreciate each individual's story, because we're really not able to help them deal with whatever their malady is in as complete or, as you said, holistic way.
Mm-hmm. You're a writer, you're a physician, you're a writer, and you teach a class at Harvard on medicine and literature. Do you think literature or art should be a part of a medical school curriculum?
Not necessarily. I mean, the course I teach is an undergraduate course. It's on narratives of illness, and there are some students there who ultimately will become doctors. Some of them went and worked for computer companies or Teach for America or whatever. I think if someone in medical school wants to take a literature course, that's fine. But I don't think it's necessary to learn or to sustain empathy or to learn the skills of really active listening and being able to engage the character of the patient. I mean, it might be helpful, but it's not a necessity. What I think is needed is a system that doesn't just pay lip service to humanism, but a system that really rewards physicians who are role models to younger doctors who really do care about patients, who know how to listen and can teach the kinds of skills that allow for story to enter into the clinic.
You mentioned about sitting at the iPad and and your internist having to write down everything that you're saying and not paying much attention. Do you have any better hope for a different system in the future?
I'm very concerned. You know, I think it will take a while before the people really revolt against this. But I saw in the paper today that, and I voted for President Obama, you know, I'm a good liberal and all of this stuff. But there are 65 quality measures that were mandated recently for these so-called medical homes or these accountable care organizations, which are supposed to be centered on the primary care doctor who takes care of you. There was an estimate that you know, people are just checking off all of these bureaucratic requirements, which is eating up all of the time. And the electronic record, which is very good for safety and medication lists and all of that, on the other hand, there's no free text. There's no way to write a person's story. Everything is checking off boxes and filling in blanks. So there are unintended consequences which are really deleterious in terms of some of the changes that have occurred. And a lot of the policymakers, I think, are relatively insensitive to the individual patient and their needs and their character.
Ms. Herman, would you agree?
I would definitely agree. And I mean, that's something I've heard from many of the doctors that I work with about the electronic medical record, that the lack of area for free text is a big problem for anyone who wants to write the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Not only, I mean, just to add, actually my wife, who's an endocrinologist, and I did a piece in the New England Journal about this, and in terms of story and taking a history and talking to a patient, because of the time pressures, there's a terrible practice now where a lot of the doctors in the hospital cut and paste. So they take other people's notes and they just copy them, you know, Microsoft Word, and then paste it in as though this is the story. And it's not. It's a cut and paste as opposed to really talking to the person and engaging that individual.
And I think, too, what that does is it erases the self of the doctor as well. So if the doctor writes a certain text and then another doctor copies and pastes it, it's the original doctor's report. And, you know, the sort of selfhood of the person that's taking care of the patient gets lost as well.
We're talking about medicine and doctors this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Myra Flato, talking with Dr. Jerome Krugman and Ms. Nellie Herman. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a call or two in here. Let's go to Melissa in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
I hope there are no tornadoes in the neighborhood today.
Not this week, just hot.
Tell us what's on your mind.
Well, I'm a physician, and I went through my residency and training and medical school about 10 years ago, and I just would like to leave a comment that I agree with your guest that idealistically when you go into medical school, you kind of have these rose-colored glasses on, and you have this ideal, you know, expectation of what your medical career is going to be like, and that empathy is there. And I think that's maintained through medical school for the most part, because they teach you, they have like all the humanities classes now in medical school, and they teach you, you know, learning your history and physical and all this, all of that. But then I think as you go through residency, you're trying to integrate, you know, all that, you know, medical knowledge in a short period of time, because you're working 80-hour work weeks and you have all of these things to do. And I think a lot of the cynicism develops then. And once you get out in practice, at least for me, that's when it started to come back in terms of, like, regaining that empathy, because I'm a pediatrician and I've learned that, you know, taking care of, you know, the little kids and the babies, you know, listening to the parents and gaining empathy helps with taking care of, you know, my patients as a whole, not just only their medical problems, but, you know, caring for them as a whole.
Mm-hmm. All right.
That's all.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that. Dr. Gropman, any comment?
I think the arc that she described is true. That probably the low point, the nadir of empathy, is during the house staff training.
Is it possible to be too empathetic?
Well, that's it is. One of the worst mistakes I ever made when I was a young hematologist, blood specialist in my training. I loved literature, and I was very interested in James Joyce and had read a lot in college, and I was taking care of this young assistant professor of English who had a cancer and was receiving intensive chemotherapy and was really quite ill and just run over by a steamroller by the treatment. And I saw him, and he had fever and so on, and we would always engage and talk about Joyce and Irish literature and all of this. I really had a deep empathetic bond with him, and I examined him in a very cursory way, and I felt so bad for him that I didn't roll him over and do a complete examination, because it was sort of disruptive, and he felt so punk. And later in the afternoon, I got an emergency page that he was in shock. And he had a bacterial infection between his buttocks, which certainly existed there several hours earlier when I went to examine him. But I had not done a complete exam, and I missed it. Now, fortunately, he didn't die. But it taught me a lesson that it's important to be empathetic, it's important to engage, but you also have to understand as a physician your own emotional temperature, and you have to make sure that you never allow your feelings or empathy to prevent you from doing what is, you know, really a competent job.
Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. And that's a great story to, it's sort of a hopeful note to end up on.
Well, thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Dr. Jerome Groopman is professor at the Harvard Medical School and chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And Nellie Herman is creative director of the narrative medicine program at Columbia University Medical School right here in New York. She's also author of The Cure for Grief. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For coming to me today. And good luck to you in your work.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. And when we come back, doctor and novelist Chris Adrian shares his stories with us. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Now you can support Science Friday and try something for free. Here's how.
This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by Carbonite Online Backup. Carbonite is designed to automatically back up files on PCs and Macs before hard drive crashes, viruses, theft, or other computer problems occur. In the event of a computer disaster, Carbonite helps restore photos, music, financial records, and other important files. Carbonite comes with anytime, anywhere access to your backed up files from any computer or via a smartphone or iPad app. To learn more about Carbonite and get a free trial, go to carbonite.com and enter the code SCIENCEFRIDAY. To secure your files and support Science Friday, go to carbonite.com and enter the code SCIENCEFRIDAY. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone, for your attention. Now back to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. After a long day at the hospital, most doctors probably want to relax. But when pediatric oncologist Chris Adrian gets home, he takes off his stethoscope and picks up a pen. What happens when a physician becomes a novelist and uses his medical and personal experiences to create a new work of fiction? Flora Lichtman is here to tell us more about it. Flora?
Chris Adrian is hard to peg. He has a degree in divinity. He has an MD. He's a fellow in pediatric hematology oncology at the University of California, San Francisco. And he also writes fiction. in which these worlds collide. Angels and demons find themselves in hospitals dealing with bumbling residents and incurable diseases. Adrian's new novel, The Great Night, is a retelling of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. But the catch is, this time, the fairy king and queen steal a mortal child who develops an ailment their magic can't fix, leukemia. So they pass many hours in a dismal hospital ward.
The ward was almost the ugliest place she had ever seen, and certainly the ugliest place she had ever lived. In other places on the wall, someone had thought to put up bas-relief cartoon faces about the size of a child's face, but the faces looked deformed to her eye, goblin faces, and they seemed uniformly to be in pain.
Chris Adrian joined us in our studio in New York a few weeks ago. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
The way that you portray doctors and hospitals is pretty different from what we see on ER or House. Do you think about that at all?
ER, I think, was in its heyday when I was a med student, and everybody, and it was something of a student ritual to gather at somebody's house and watch it. And
is that right? Really? Mm-hmm. Doctors watch ER?
Mm-hmm. Wow. And we learn, and we oddly enough, it could be helpful for the boards or for tests because they generally got their medicine right. But certainly there was something that we recognized of our own experience in representations like that. But as I grew up as a physician, there started to be a lot that I didn't necessarily see in popular representations. And in a book like the Children's Hospital, I think I may perhaps have gone a little overboard in the other direction.
I'd love for you to read a little passage from the Children's Hospital.
Sure.
This was one of my favorite places. Maybe you can tell us just a little bit more, set the scene a little bit.
Okay. So the novel is about a hospital that's floating around in the ocean after the end of the world again. So there's a second flood, despite the fact that God promised not to flood the world again. It happens anyway. And the only folks who survive are the people who happen to be in the hospital, either as patients or employees. So Gemma Claflin is the essentially the main character. And Gemma is sort of a not very well put together or with it medical student. Medicine may not really have been her true calling. But she finds, as the weeks go by, that people are getting, she's doing, not necessarily doing things right, but kids are getting better around her. And eventually she figures out that she actually is able to heal people just by the power of her will alone or by wanting it enough. And she wants very badly to be able to help these children. And I think in this passage, she's with a young lady with sickle cell disease whose name is Magnolia. Gemma conceived the fix as an argument for a period of time that could be measured only by the languid ticking of Magnolia's hair. Gemma instructed a stubborn stem cell in the marrow of Magnolia's hip on the proper synthesis of hemoglobin. Like this, she told it, holding up in her mind the lovely molecule pointers of green fire indicating the place where the cell was doing wrong and how to do it right. It wanted to know why like that and not like it had always been done. It wanted to know who Gemma thought she was, barging into the marrow in the middle of the night to demand that the sun rise in the west instead of the east. As if in defiance, it squeezed out some faulty molecule. "You're killing her," Gemma said furiously. "Her who?" the cell said. "Who is she and who are you?" "I am," Gemma said. "I am." "Who was she? Who was she to do these things, to declare a new order to the sick body? It was not a question profitably to be pursued here in the middle of things." She crushed its stubborn will, the smallest violence she would do that evening, commandeering the machines of its molecular industry and churning out perfect hemoglobin in a swelling tide. "See," she asked it, "now do you see?" "Yes," it said, and it proclaimed the secret to its neighbor. But with that information, it passed along also a hint of feeling, the sullen residue of wounded pride. Gemma tried to burn it out, afraid it would turn sweet Magnolia into a sulker who'd eschew the taste of delight to feed on habitual resentment.
Oh, there's so much to talk about there. You have a degree in divinity, and at least your characters in your book, many of them seem to believe in the power of things beyond this, the documented scientific world. And I wondered if you, having been trained as a doctor and in theology, if you feel that those two things are at odds, or do they work together?
They haven't been particularly at odds for me, I guess. Or at least I have. I find that I don't have trouble operating in the evidence-based world of pediatric oncology, but then also operating in the not-so-evidence-based sort of anecdotal experience, individual experience-based world of, I guess I can call it pastoral care or ministry, even though I'm not a minister and probably won't ever get ordained. But I certainly think that what I've learned in divinity school, and I went in part, aside from wanting to know more about theology because of what I was working on as a writer, I went because I knew I wanted to be a pediatric oncologist, and I thought I would learn things there about how to take care of patients that I wouldn't necessarily learn in the hospital. People who are going through what is very likely to be the worst time of their lives. So I think that what I learned as a divinity student or as a ministry student is not incompatible at all with what I learned in the hospital. I guess the closest that the ministerial side and the evidence-based side come to being in conflict is just in having, I guess, a healthy respect for the possibilities of mystery or even miracle is probably not too strong a word. And for me, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, the knitting circle at church prayed for so-and-so and they got better. It just means that there is a lot that we don't know, even though there's a lot that we do know in medicine.
Do you have parents who you've worked with, for children that you've treated, have they read your stuff? Have you heard any reaction?
A little bit. Up until the past couple of years, I guess, that tended to be less of a problem, if problem is the right word for it. And so sometimes, especially if, you know, there was one occasion where a mom had just read a story that was about a ne'er-do-well pediatrician who was a drug addict, and she realized I was the person that wrote that story just as I was about to do a relatively not very complicated, but kind of a dramatic procedure on her child. So that made for a mildly awkward conversation about the differences between real life and fiction. With this story, the idea of Titania and Oberon being the parents of a critically ill child came from an interaction with a particular child and a particular set of parents. And before it was published, I approached them and said, I need to have a really funny conversation with you. I basically told them that the story that had been accepted for publication had a lot to do with their child. They probably would recognize their child because the sort of line that was at the center of the story and the title of the story was something charming and brilliant that their child had said that I had had borrowed. Or
is that the Tiny Feast story from The Great Night, your new book?
Uh-huh. So the situation was that there was this, you know, enormously charming and lovely little girl who we had, as part of her treatment, stopped letting eat. She couldn't take anything by mouth, which upset her, understandably. And the physicians and the med students and the social workers and the rest of the ginormous team that goes around in the morning was in her room talking to her parents and sort of ignoring her or waiting for like the last few minutes of the visit when we turn to the child and say, is there anything you'd like to add? And she interrupted us halfway through and said essentially something to the effect of, what's wrong with you people? Why can't I have just one tiny little feast? Everybody got repeated around the war. It is something enormously charming, but also kind of heartbreaking, certainly something that gave us a pretty dramatic window onto what the world was like for her in that moment and what we were making it like for her.
Dead brothers appear a lot in your fiction. And I know this is personal for you, but something that struck me as I was reading it, I was reminded of the story of Cain and Abel and how the surviving brother lives marked. And with your training in divinity, I wondered if this story in particular had crossed your mind when you were writing that, or if I'm just totally reaching.
not totally. Certainly all those, I grew up Catholic, and pretty, even though I wasn't in a very religious family, I was a somewhat serious child and took my Catholicism pretty seriously. The frequency of dead brother appearances in my fiction has less to do with echoes of those sort of primal stories I was exposed to as a kid than with the fact of my own brother's death when I was 22 and he was 25. Fiction became a way to sort of explore being obsessed by the fact of his death and the injustice of his death, but I think as I turned his death over again and again in my mind and in my writing, that I drew in on my previous experience of old stories. And I think one thing I discovered in a late reading of the Cain and Abel story that I had completely missed as a child was that that Cain is marked for Abel's death, but as a protection, not as a in a way that's necessarily punitive. God sets him aside as somebody who has killed his brother, and that idea of being permanently marked and marked as culpable, and the way the invitation to rhapsodize on the varieties of guilt that surviving any kind of death, regardless of whether or not you can convince yourself you're remotely culpable or guilty, even in just the sense of the guilt of survivorship, I think that old story entered into my new stories.
You're listening to Science Friday on NPR. Yeah, it seems like that is the power of story for authors and for readers, to be able to sort of make sense of something that seems just incomprehensible.
Certainly with my own stuff, with my writing, I think that at least every long project has started with being deeply troubled about something, and then with this book, with the new novel, the experience in the first year that I was learning to be a pediatric oncologist, and also the experience of having a relationship fall apart in just the right way that made it suddenly very necessary and urgent to write a story about love. And I think that for me, I feel like I ultimately always miss the mark, but that's okay in a way. It seems pathetically naive to think telling a story could really make everything all better, because that seems almost as pathetic as thinking telling a story could make an actual sick child better. It doesn't. The worst outcome that I deal with professionally, when a child dies, there's nothing that's ever going to make that better. And so it's naive to think that that something as simple as telling an emotionally resonant story would help. And yet, there is, for me, as a physician, the reason I think I can, at least now, the reason I can get up and go back to work every morning despite those outcomes is because those parents get up and go back to work. They go back to their regular lives. They love their remaining children, and they get it together and get on with it. And they don't just live. They don't just survive. They live and they thrive in a way that is wonderful and mysterious to me. And just the simple fact or the privilege of getting to witness not just their trauma and their tragedy, but how much they love their children and how extraordinarily powerful, even though it can ultimately be helpless and powerless, that love is, turns out to look a lot like what that target is that I'm always just missing in the fiction. So in that sense, it's not useless at all. It's fundamentally important.
Well, if missing the mark means you'll keep writing, I hope you continue to miss.
I can guarantee you I'll keep missing for a while yet.
Thank you, Chris Adrian, for joining us today.
Thank you. This was really neat.
Chris Adrian is a fellow in pediatric hematology oncology at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also a fiction writer. His new book is called The Great Night.
Thank you, Flora. Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.